I would like to call the House Finance Committee meeting to order. Today is Saturday, April 27, 2019, and the time is 2:02. My apologies for being 2 minutes late. I will work on that. Today, it is my intention on having the different agencies here to speak to HB 20 as the committee substitute has been put forward. We're going to do things a little differently than we have done in the past. If you are thinking of ideas that you would like to see in a bill, and you might want to know whether or not this is an issue or might be the cost that might be done to the state or toward other people, it's kind of an open discussion. What I do ask is that we don't just refer to specific bills that are not before us, but that it's concepts that could possibly be in other bills, because there are a lot of crime bills going around right now. But today is really our time to be able to gather the information, so as we get ready to do the amendment process, people feel more comfortable with their amendments and being able to explain them. I will also allow for this portion of when we get into amendments, if we need to have the agencies before us, because this is very complicated, and you as the amendment maker may call anybody up that you feel necessary to help you out. We want to get this right. We know that SB 91 had some problems, and we want to make sure we don't go down that same trail. We want to make Alaska much safer. So with that, we're going to start with taking the roll so we all know we're here. Representative Merrick is here. Representative Joseph, Representative Leonard, Representative Ortiz, Representative Knopp, Representative LeBond, Representative Tilton, Representative Carpenter, Vice Chair Johnston, and Co-Chair Foster. I'm Representative Wilson. We have a quorum to do business, and we're going to start with Health and Social Services. Mr. Newman. And this will pertain to the juvenile justice portion of our work draft. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tony Newman. I'm with the Department of Health and Social Services, and I've made myself available for questions on how the committee substitute for House Bill 20 affects the juvenile justice system primarily. There's just one small piece here that affects DJJ. It's in Section 22, the piece that pulls in the for electronic monitoring, changes the offense of the crime of escape in the third degree. And the CSIC, it's on page 13. And you'll see that this section of the bill provides that the crime of escape in the third degree applies if, while someone is under official detention for misdemeanor, without prior authorization, one leaves one's residence or other place designated by the Commissioner of Corrections or the Commissioner of Health and Social Services for services by electronic monitoring. We do place juveniles on electronic monitoring in the Division of Juvenile Justice, so this would apply to them, and the division feels this is a good tool for the division to have for the very small number of youth who are placed on electronic monitoring. I understand it's fewer than a dozen at any given time are on electronic monitoring, and should they try and tamper with their device or otherwise not use the device, this crime would apply.
Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you to the chair. When youth are put on electronic monitoring, or even when there's an opportunity or a chance that they could have a felony charge against them, once they reach adulthood, does that felony charge sometimes go away?
Through the chair, Representative Johnston, a felony charge, a felony adjudication for a juvenile remains on their record. And although confidentiality will prohibit it from generally being shared with other people, but a felony adjudication for a juvenile remains on their record, if I'm understanding
okay,
your
yes,
question.
Thank you.
Any other questions on juvenile justice through the Health and Social Services? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify, and I think we understood before during the previous meeting this morning that a juvenile under this situation here removes or tampers with or disables the electronic monitoring equipment would be charged with a felony as well. That is correct, yes?
Just a moment. If the offense crime of escape in the third degree is a felony, then that is true.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you so much for being with us today, Mr. Newman. And next, I think we'll go to the court system. Ms. Mead?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System, and I'm just here for questions.
Representative Knopp.
So I guess it will be a question for Ms. Mead and question for the rest of you as well, and I think Representative Carpenter brought it up. But and I think I just heard Mr. Newman say that, yes, if a juvenile removes his electronic monitoring equipment and escapes, he will be charged with a felony. And I think I heard Mr. Newman say that it sticks with him. Ms. Mead, is that true? It sticks with a juvenile into adulthood? Is it always reflected on a record?
Through the chair to Representative Knopp, I may not be the best person, but Mr. Newman can correct me. My understanding is that he or she would be charged with the felony, but it would be handled by DJJ, the Division of Juvenile Justice, and the person would not person who goes through the Division of Juvenile Justice after being charged with a crime ends up not with a quote conviction, but with an adjudication as a juvenile delinquent. In that regard, it does stay on the person's permanent absent records within public safety. It is not publicized. There is an exception for certain crimes that are automatically, if committed or charged against a juvenile, waived into adult court. To my knowledge, escape is not one of those automatic waiver crimes, but the prosecutor could seek to have that juvenile waived into an adult court, in which case he or she would be treated as an adult.
And follow. So I think the question goes to the body at this point. I do have concerns about a felony showing up on a juvenile, in somebody's record when they are no longer a juvenile in a felony case for less serious crimes, an escape. So I just food for thought for the rest of you guys, if that's the path we want to go down there. I'm not sure I'm 100% comfortable with that. But.
Okay. When you think about Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This morning during floor, we learned a little bit more about the devices used for electronic monitoring, and apparently there's some sort of base station that the ankle monitor talks back and forth to. And I just want to confirm that when it says removes tampers with or disables the electronic monitoring equipment, that includes the base station. And if so, if you have a base station at work, how can you, and you're not there if you're at home, how can you assure that someone else doesn't tamper with that piece of equipment?
Through the chair to Representative Merrick, I would defer questions on actual operations of electronic monitors to the Department of Corrections. As I read the statute, however, I would read this as applying to tampering with any piece of the electronic monitoring device, no matter where it is. So I'm sorry, I don't know exactly how all electronic monitors work.
Okay, thank you. Any follow-up?
Follow-up?
I would like to know how they secure the devices so that it's ensured that someone else doesn't tamper with it, and then the defendant would get blamed for it if it was something that they didn't do.
And we will have corrections as well, so you can repose those questions to them. Those are very good questions. We need to better understand, because I didn't know about the stations either. I thought they could actually monitor it from the ankle. Representative Josephson.
I was going to talk a little bit about this topic and juvenile adjudications, but I think I'll move on from that and wait for that opportunity.
I think you'd be better.
Here.
If it has to do with electronic monitoring, we should wait for corrections on those.
No, I was going to ask, are we inquiring about any issue that affects the court system?
Yes.
Right? Okay. Under that,
Representative Josephson.
Those guidelines. Through the chair, Ms. Mead. I am liking what I'm seeing in the committee substitute for House Bill 20. There's one provision that I may need some guidance on, and it's relative to the C felony issue for possession. And I guess part of what I'm wondering is who knows, who in the universe of Alaskans involved in this knows the most about the programs and their availability. That's what we've been talking about the last week. So, for example, if one were to offer a change to this that said this heroin usage is a C felony, but it can be not expunged, but not imposed, if you do X and Y, what should X and Y say? I mean, as I sit here now, it would say, it would refer to maybe veterans court, therapeutic court, inpatient treatment. These are just the words that come to mind. And I'm just wondering, I couldn't possibly know how to craft such a thing without knowing the universe of options that we could insist they take in lieu of jail. Does that make sense?
Through the chair to Representative Josephson, yes, it does make sense to me. I would point out that one of the provisions of SB 91 created that very mechanism. It's called a suspended entry of judgment. We call it an SEJ. It's not an SIS, which you may be used to from when you practice. That's a suspended imposition of judgment. The suspended entry of judgment, however, which is not proposed to be repealed, to my knowledge, anywhere at all this year, is a tool for prosecutors to come to a deal with the defendant. The defendant pleads guilty, but that judgment is suspended. It is not entered until the defendant finishes a probationary term, which would include treatment and other things, probably payment of restitution. And when and if that defendant finishes all those requirements, that case can be dismissed. And so that is a tool available, and I think I heard Mr. Skidmore say this morning that they hope to be using it more and more for things like drug possession cases. And I guess to get back to your initial question of who knows about all the programs, I would suggest that maybe somebody from DHSS or even the executive director of the Mental Health Trust has a good handle on what's available where. But I guess I'd say that SEJ provision does provide the tools needed.
And I guess on the programming, I guess some of our concern on the committee was when the courts say that you need to have treatment in a certain area and they don't have necessarily that treatment there, you know, are we actually putting people at risk because of the vast state that we have and kind of more rural that we get, the less opportunities they are. So it doesn't just make it bad for the offender, but also possibly if, you know, they reoffend. So does the judges have like a list of, you know, programs in the areas so that they know whether or not it's going to be difficult to be able to fulfill whatever the court is ordered?
To the chair, sometimes that is true. I mean, I would say it's generally true that the judges in Anchorage know what sort of programs are available in Anchorage. But to clarify one of your statements, the judge doesn't order somebody to any particular treatment or in any particular area. If they, the process I just described, the suspended entry of judgment, for example, everybody has to agree, and the defense attorney is there and the prosecuting attorney, and they aren't going to agree to something impossible. So. So there's a conversation that takes place. And it's a little bit different from what we talked about the other day in response to Representative Carpenter's questions about treatment as a condition of probation. Because in those situations, the court does not know where the defendant will ultimately want to live after serving a certain time in prison. But for these programs that allow deferred sentencing or suspended entry of the judgment, there's a conversation that takes place to ensure that the court doesn't impose impossible things.
So I'm going to go on a question on pretrial. So we've heard a lot about the tool and the release of the tool as we're kind of looking at possible amendments that we may have. Do the courts feel that that the tool has some validity to it and is helpful in any fashion?
To the chair, just like with legislators, some judges think it's great and some judges don't. And so we don't take a position on its validity or usefulness. I will say, because the law says that it must be consulted, our clerks download them every morning and print them and put them in the file. And the judge and the attorneys, because the law says you must, you know, use this risk assessment tool, look at it and figure out what decision-making structure they're in, because that's what the tool says to do. So I don't think I can go further than that with a position on whether that's a wise thing or not.
So if we made the tool more advisory, then we would really go back to the times before the tool where once they would still receive the information, but then we would be back prior to SB 91 where ultimately the decision would be up to the court, to the judge, to say that even though they might have scored low risk, I'm seeing this particular person for the third time in a couple of weeks of being able to make their own judgment and just and not be forced into a decision.
To the chair, also just to clarify, the tool now is there's nothing mandatory about our bail statute anymore. That was corrected or adjusted with SB 54, because prior to that there used to be mandatory releases depending on the score. So that's no longer part of the release decision. It is the presumption of release unless there's clear and convincing evidence that something, that this person is a threat to public safety or fails to appear. So that's our current law. So to say that the tool is advisory, in some ways, it's a little bit, you could say it's advisory now. However, it does, for certain crimes, the court has no presumption whatsoever. And those are all your serious felonies or any crime against a person, because the goal was to separate violent crimes from nonviolent. So yes, to get at your exact question, you could say no presumption and use the tool kind of as you see fit, as just another piece of information in the bail decision making, which would bring you, I think your question was, closer to what the bail decisions used to be, which was just the judge making using his or her discretion, and here would be another piece of information that the judge could use. So yes, you could do that.
Thank you for the clarification. There's a lot of moving parts here, and we want to make sure as accurate as we can. Are there any other questions for Ms. Mead? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to go to public safety. Looks like we have Ms. Schroeder in the audience. I mean, Kelly Howe, sorry. Ms. Howe, would you like to come up? We do have both. I just had them in the wrong departments. My apologies. Can you please put yourself on the record? I didn't know who you were.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kelly Howell. I am the Special Assistant to the Commissioner and the Legislative Liaison for the Department of Public Safety. I am here to answer questions, but I can tell you that we have subject matter experts from the department online. We just had our Deputy Commissioner, Michael Duxbury, call in after the other committee ended. So he is online, and we also have individuals from the State Crime Lab to answer questions related to sections dealing with the sexual assault kit testing provisions, and Deputy Commissioner Duxbury to answer any questions related to the drug provisions of this bill.
Okay, so we're not showing Mr. Duxbury currently online. Oh, I think he just got online. Okay, well, there you go. So with that, do we have any questions for public safety? Well, I guess I will start. So we heard, Representative Johnston, go ahead.
I probably should let you start because I'm still somewhat formulating this in my head. And with the amended bill, I don't know enough about quantities of drugs to see the felonies and how we're changing them. Are these, as you look at this bill, are you looking at this increase time for felonies in a way that we're now addressing the issue of drug traffickers versus users? How do we sit as far as the amounts in this bill?
Representative Johnston, through the chair, I'd like to defer that question to our Deputy Commissioner, Michael Duxbury. He, prior to becoming the Deputy Commissioner, he was the commander of our statewide drug enforcement unit and has a vast amount of experience and knowledge in that area and can better articulate an answer than I can.
Mr. Duxbury, could you please put yourself on the record and please help Representative Johnston. Are you on mute by any chance? He seems like he has dropped offline.
We can come back to that.
Chair.
Okay, we'll try another question, and if not, then we might bring public safety back up if they need to call back in. Go ahead, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, actually, relative to DPS, there are some sections in this CS relative to the requirement for the provision of a DNA sample that they're in the governor's bill but not in, in this bill, and I'm wondering about their relevancy without knowing much about Representative Tarr's bill in detail. I assume there's, you got to have DNA samples to make rape kits the most valuable they can be. And I'm just trying to, if you, if there's something you want to share with us about those things. And the things I mean for the record are the governor's request that people be punished theoretically with jail time if they refuse to provide a DNA sample. Is this in your bailiwick or?
Representative Josephson, through the chair, those specific provisions in the governor's bill, as you stated, would have made refusal to provide DNA upon arrest for qualifying offenses a crime. Currently, it is not a crime. DNA is collected upon arrest, and when someone refuses, right now there's not a criminal penalty for that. In terms of how that impacts the provisions for the sexual assault kit testing, those individuals whose DNA is not collected would not be potentially entered into CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System. And I may defer to the crime lab for any technical questions related to that and when a sample is actually eligible to be entered into CODIS, into that system. So it may be helpful to have them provide some of the more fine points of that answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to admit I haven't properly digested everything in here, so I'm trying to extrapolate something here. With regard to vehicle theft, is that anywhere in this combination of 20 and 49? And if so, could you assist me in describing that? And are we looking at harsher penalties for vehicle theft?
Representative Sullivan Leonard, through the chair, I could not tell you without doing a little bit deeper dive into the committee substitute whether that is in here. That probably is a better question for the Department of Law, and I don't know if we have anyone available.
We do. We have the Department of Law, so if we can hold off till we have them, but we do have them online and also in the room, so we can come back with that question when they're before us. Now we have Mr. Duxbury back on the line, so we're going to go back to Representative Johnston's question. Mr. Duxbury, could you please put yourself on the record, and then we'll have Representative Johnston ask her question again.
Yes, ma'am. Yes, Madam Chair. This is Michael Duxbury, Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Public Safety.
Thank you. Representative Johnston.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, as I'm looking at this bill, I'm trying to get my arms around it and to understand, as we're increasing the sentencing for drugs and the amounts of drugs, do you look at this as increasing the sentencing in for what would be a drug dealer versus somebody who uses drugs? I don't have a clue as far as some of the amounts that are in this bill.
Through the chair, Senator Johnston, what I can say to you is it's a difficult thing in today's world to determine what a small amount and what a large amount of drugs is. And I would give you that in by describing when we classify drugs, Schedule 1A, Schedule 2A, even within Schedule 1A, the difference in Schedule 1A for the potency, the lethality, and the ability to impact different locations is significant. I would give it to you as one form of explanation if this would help, and that will say talking with DEA chemists to try to figure out in layman's terms what is the potency difference in just some of the Schedule 1As that we're dealing with. and it would go like this. An oxycodone would be given a power of 1. Then a morphine would be given the power of 10. Heroin would be given the power of 100. And fentanyl, which we're seeing in a lot of the heroin that is in the state, would be given the power of 10,000. In addition, I'm sorry, 1,000. In addition to that, carfentanil, which is also being used at times as an additive to some of this heroin, opioid, a Schedule 1A drug, would be given the power of 10,000. So if we just took the difference between heroin and fentanyl, which are those two things are showing up in Alaska and a lot, a single gram, which is about, take a package of sugar and cut it in four, and you'd have one of those fours would be a gram. That's 10 doses of heroin. Most people that are using heroin, even if they're just the street-level user, are trying to sell a good portion of that to keep their life rolling for the day. If you were to have a gram of fentanyl, you'd have to look at it in the form of one grain of salt of fentanyl or enough to cover the, at least not one grain of salt, but enough to cover the date on a penny would be a lethal dose. So having a significant amount of that in a gram, you kill a lot of people. And that's the problem we have, and that is the reason we needed the tool. But to incorporate small amounts that we take from somebody and making it a felony was also going to be incorporated with the SEJ and the suspended imposition of sentence kind of thought process. So a one-time incident isn't necessarily something that provides somebody with a great deal of jail time, but it also does provide them with impetus for us to get them into treatment, for us to have them help us find out where the larger amounts are coming from. Does that answer your question?
Follow-up?
Follow-up.
Sort of. I think I'm following where you're going. I guess where my concern is, and this is why this all becomes so complicated, is that you know with users, you're dealing with people who have an addiction problem and maybe even mental illness problems. And I put and even users who maybe are used as mules or as, you know, they're used by dealers to get their drug to market. My thought is that I'm not sure if I'm ready to take that jump to make them into felons. But I understand when public safety was talking before, and you know, a lot of my sense of public safety is what I see on television, to be, I mean, I'd like to read in books. the whole thing of going to a drug user and getting the drug user to squeal on their dealer. And there's been a thought that you're losing that tool. I'm just trying to find that fine line because I'm not sure how effective that has ever been, first of all. And secondly, are we in increasing these sentencing for the drug user / dealer, or are we increasing the sentencing for what you would call more a dealer and some, you know, where it's we're really trying to take the drug off the market? I'm sorry for that long, but it isn't easy in my mind.
So did you want to respond?
Through the chair, Senator Johnston, two things that you mentioned here. One is, are we trying to improve our ability to sentence the major dealer? And yes, that is one of the things that is an attempt with the return of this to pre-91, SB-91 issues. The second thing that you mentioned was, are we, you know, with the addict, is it an appropriate form of enforcement? Do we provide an inducement for that person under the situation to get into treatment? And are we using that to go after the larger dealers? I can say from my experience, we do not do ourselves any favors in terms of it doesn't do us any good to put addicts in jail. That's not what we need to do. What we are doing, though, when we do this, is we are absolutely capable of getting and using these issues as the impetus to drive us towards creating enforcement programs that help us with the quality of life issues. And what I mean by that is a number of folks call and tell us about the drug houses down the street or about the traffic that's going out in and out of a place. Usually that kind of trafficking involves very small amounts that the people are using, as you're saying. Often those people will take some of those small amounts and then sell them themselves so they can make enough money to stay going for the day and get some more drugs themselves. It is difficult because right now under only being able to issue a citation under those situations most times that the inertia doesn't have in within the system doesn't have enough time to actually put time and effort into prosecuting those individuals. Nothing is happening in their lives where accountability causes them to change their lifestyle or want to help us. And we have traditionally used those small amounts to get to the person that is the bigger dealer. And oftentimes, things like this suspended entry of judgment and suspended entry, suspended SIS is forgetting the word, but were great tools for us to accomplish those tasks. And it also turned into a situation for the state doing these cases where we'd end up having to turn over all these cases that we were doing to the federal government so they could prosecute them. And now we're having people in federal jails, and maybe those people are going out of state to jail instead of staying here. So a lot of components of what we used to do in order to be at least productive in for the state were handed off to other people like the federal government. And the secondary thing was we had a difficult time taking care of the quality of life issues that your constituents were calling in about.
One last follow-up.
Follow-up.
So I guess where I'm looking at this is difference between changing the sentencing in your misdemeanors to and when do you then bump it up to a felony and then change that sentencing? And so do you see any flexibility for some of the, and, you know, drug houses probably is a great example, where you have small amounts and somebody is trying to support the drug habit, keeping that as much a misdemeanor with a higher sentencing as, or it sounds like to me you are looking at the new, and now I forgot the acronym for it, but the tool as far as holding the felony over their head if they get certain, if they go for treatment is more effective than increasing the sentencing in the misdemeanor. And is that what I hear?
Through the chair, Senator Johnston, I have a decidedly law enforcement perspective about some of the what you're talking about. I take some of my lead on the SEJ that you were mentioning from Mr. Skidmore, who will very soon here be the Deputy Attorney General, I believe, but he's been head of criminal for a while. And he understands the resources that they have and how they will utilize those tools to help folks. But we also have to remember from the law enforcement public safety perspective is at this day and age, a gram of heroin is capable with fentanyl on it harming to overdose and sometimes death at least 10 people, 1 gram. So that's my perspective. I want to be able to stop that insidious small-time dealing that happens because you buy a certain amount, and here's another thing. It's 1/10 of a gram, less than the size of a quarter of a penny, is the normal dose of black tar heroin, and that is going for $100 to $200 in some of our locations. So a gram would be $1,000. And the money's getting sucked out of this place. It takes over everything in a person's life. They stop. They'll give up water and food just to have that. So you make great references to the addiction in that issue, but it also takes the lethality of it now is different than it's ever been before.
I appreciate your perspective. Thank you.
So I have a question. So one of the things I've heard from my constituents more than any time is that the police have wanted them to videotape the neighbor who's having all that traffic. I'm not exactly sure what they're supposed to see, but with the changes that we're trying to make here in House Bill 20, will this give more opportunity for AST to be able to go into these houses and not necessarily need the neighbor videotaping for them?
So, Madam Chair, Michael Duxbury, one thing first that comes to mind is the Constitution is very important to all of us, and that will depend on the circumstances and what we're doing. There are some enforcement efforts that I'd like not to necessarily describe in full to you, but there are some enforcement efforts that is a lot easier because it takes a lot of time to do the surveillance and do all the work, but when a law enforcement officer in a patrol car pulls over a guy and he has a small amount of heroin on him that he just bought in another location, it makes it a lot easier now that there's some sort of, oh my God, I'm in kind of trouble here. I'm either going to want to cooperate, or I'm going to want to maybe tell him that with cooperation, I want some consideration, and I'd like to get some. This has happened to me. Now I know I have to get some help. Our officers can help the drug units and themselves by being able to walk that back now to the place where it comes from. When it's only a citation, we don't develop the reasonable suspicion probable cause entity that we need for the warrants to get back into these houses. And so this is going to give us some tools to really have impact on quality of life issues in neighborhoods.
Thank you. And then one other question on a different note. Would you be willing to help corrections with your drug dogs to go through the correction facilities so we have less drugs mm-hmm. in them?
I can tell you this. One of the things with the Constitution in the state of Alaska is, and I would have to understand how this works and get with both John Skidmore and the lawyers for the jail, is that is we are not allowed to, in normal circumstances, place a dog on anything that we feel like the dog can sniff. The law in Alaska states that I have to have probable cause before I can even put a dog on something. So a misnomer that you see a lot of times is, why don't we just have dogs in the airport to keep this stuff from going through? Can't do that. That's an invasion of privacy in the state of Alaska. Now, for the jail, I am willing to collaborate with those folks, and my commissioner and the deputy and the commissioner from DOC have already had discussions about how we could do better, and we are already doing drug investigations in the jail. It would take nothing for us to just look at the next step and see if that's a possibility.
So are you telling me that my rights were violated in the Anchorage airport when the dog came walking by all of us because the line was so long?
No, that dog that came walking by you, ma'am, was a federal operated dog, or even if it was a local police dog, if it was attached to TSA, that's a federal rule that has the Department of Homeland Security and its rules that allow them to search for dangerous items like a bomb. However, you and I, and we have all been talking about fentanyl right now and how dangerous that is, we can't do that with a drug dog.
Wow, so they can violate our rights. Huh, I didn't know that, honestly. Representative Joseph,
it's not really considered violating your rights because the law allows for that, but it would be for me if someone was to just to put no reason at all, had no probable cause to get a dog or even a warrant to come up to you and just sniff you for drugs, that would be a different story.
Well, even though the law may allow it, I'm pretty sure I still feel like my rights were violated. But I'll take that up with TSA. I'm sure they'll be wanting to listen to me. Representative Josephson.
Thank you, through the chair, for Deputy Commissioner Duxbury. It may be also a question for the Department of Law, but I'm trying to get a sense, sir, about the two tracks in a C felony where a proposed new C felony, where one track was there's nothing wrong with me, I don't want to do this, just impose the year of jail or whatever you want to do. The other track is, I got to fix myself, I need treatment. And I'm trying to figure out how the cooperation fits into that. I'm a believer in cooperation, that is, where someone knows something about, obviously, the dealer, and they're willing to take that sort of risk and be helpful. But if the quid pro quo for not going to jail is go to treatment, where I'm trying to figure out where the incentive lays for the defendant to say, oh, I'm also willing to do this other thing. So it creates a third leg to the stool, and I'm just trying to get a sense of how that would work.
Through the chair, Senator Josephson, this is Deputy Commissioner Michael Duxbury, Department of Public Safety. So I can tell you from the law enforcement perspective what the first things that we think about is. Law enforcement does not make offers to individuals themselves. What they do is, in conjunction with the Department of Law, with a prosecuting attorney, discuss with them the possibilities of their cooperation gaining them a degree of consideration that would be important to them. So what this bill and what the discussion is about is providing, again, a level of discretion and some tools to work within what can be a very a wide-ranging, complicated series of events from one individual who's the first time ever, which I have never dealt with an individual's the first time that he's ever been using a drug or first time he's ever sold a drug. Normally, these folks come into our purview after many days, months, and sometimes years of involvement in the drug trade in some respect. So we approach those situations utilizing the rules of the Constitution and our policies and procedures. And when we get to a point where somebody thinks that they want to help us find out where it comes from, that this might give them some consideration, that always takes place with a consultation within the Department of Law.
Okay. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did I understand correctly that inmates have a right to privacy and that a dog from a law enforcement agency would not be able to enter the prison and do a search? Is that understood?
Mr. Duxbury.
Madam Chair, Senator, I didn't mean to give you that impression. The impression I should give you is I do not know the extent of the legality under which we could operate at that point in time. And is whenever those are questions in our law enforcement issues, we always cooperate and collaborate with the other agency that we're going to be interacting with, and we would seek often we do consultation with legal assistance from the Department of Law.
Well, our question from yesterday, we understood that the Department of Corrections has one dog, and they've been trying to work with public safety and trying to come up with some kind of agreement. So that's kind of where our question has come from. So, but we do have the Department of Law. We could probably make sure that it's, you know, get more into Representative Carpenter's answer question at that point to find out the legality of it. Good question. Any more questions for public safety? Seeing none, thank you so much for being here. And sounds like we need to hear from the Department of Law next. We have Casey Schroeder in the audience, and we also have Robert Henderson for questions online. So, yeah. So we're going to go with Mr. Henderson. Mr. Henderson, can you please put yourself on the record, and then we'll go to questions.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Robert Henderson, Deputy Attorney General for the Criminal Division, Department of Law.
Thank you for being with us here on a Saturday. We're going to go back to Representative Sullivan Leonard to start with.
Thank you, Madam Chair, to Mr. Henderson. My concern is with regard to vehicular theft. We've seen a continued rise in that across the state of Alaska, very notably in my community. Does this particular piece of legislation address that, and is there a harsher sentence for those that are committing these repeat crimes?
So through the chair, Representative, in looking at the committee substitute for House Bill 20, House Bill 20, as currently drafted, would not address this issue. And let me expound on that a little bit. So vehicle theft is a Class C felony offense. The committee substitute for House Bill 20 in Section 33, so that's pages 24, adjusts the presumptive ranges for Class B felonies. It does not adjust the presumptive ranges for Class C felonies. So for Class C felony offense, a first-time offender who's convicted of a vehicle theft would face a presumptive term of 0 to 2 years.
Thank you.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to clarify the previous question about drug dog usage within the prison population, is there a presumptive right to privacy that would prevent a law enforcement dog from entering into the prison and augmenting the prison or Department of Corrections dog population in searching drugs out within the population?
So, through the chair, Representative, so under Alaska Constitution, all resident citizens have a heightened expectation of privacy in Alaska that's beyond and greater than what's provided under the federal Constitution. That being said, prisoners and those within a correctional facility have a lower or a lessened expectation of privacy. So the short answer to your question is Department of Corrections could use a dog in its efforts within the facility.
Follow up? Can they use a dog that is owned or assigned to a law enforcement agency, not a Department of Corrections dog?
Through the chair, Representative, yes.
Thank you.
We might have some cooperation going on here. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To follow up with Representative Carpenter's question, what about the corrections officers? Are they subject to those same rules of privacy? As a member of the law enforcement community, would they be able to, have those same searches? Because we've heard from a couple people that a lot of the drugs come in through the corrections officers.
Through the chair, Representative, that's a more complicated question, and I'd frankly want to take a little bit of time and think through that a little bit. Generally speaking, when an inmate is within a correctional facility, as I stated, they have a lower expectation of privacy. There is also a lower expectation of privacy generally within a correctional facility. That being said, a corrections officer as an employee has an expectation of privacy as to their workspace. So I don't want to suggest that Department of Corrections can't ensure that drugs aren't coming into the facility, but there would be protections and there would be some circumstances that I'd want to think through before, before I advised either Department of Corrections or Department of Public Safety. I'd want to think through some nuanced legal issues.
And we'd like a follow-up on that, because I think basically if a dog was being taken through a facility and for whatever reason that dog stopped on that person or locker or wherever it would be, I could see maybe there might be some privacy areas. But if that seems to be the problem and we were going to utilize that and that would be off limits, then I'm not too sure how helpful it would be. So if you could kind of look into that, I think the committee would greatly appreciate that. And we want to make sure people have privacy, but we also want to make sure we're keeping drugs out of our correction facilities. And we're not saying anybody's doing it. We just have heard and had letters sent to us that, sadly enough, and I just got one the other day, that they find it easier to get drugs within the facility than even outside of the facility. So there's obviously a major issue here. Representative Josephson.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Henderson, relative to the C felonies, which you spoke of a few minutes ago, is the reason that HB 20 and the governor's comparable bills don't take up C felonies is because we fixed that and we quote fixed that close quote in Senate Bill 54, right?
So through the chair, Representative. So SB 54 did change the presumptive sentencing for first-time C felons felonies from a 18-month probationary sentence to a 0 to 2 sentencing range. But for clarification, the administration's classification and sentencing bill does address presumptive ranges for Class C felonies. Although that is not within the committee substitute before this committee.
Okay, I'll have to look for that. And a follow-up?
Follow-up.
Specifically as to vehicle theft, my colleague, Representative Fields, has a mandatory minimum bill, but the administration doesn't have that in any of its legislation. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative, that's correct. The mandatory minimum is not part of the administration's classification and sentencing bills.
Thank you.
So I have a more general question. So as we're going through these bills, and we are not attorneys, well, maybe some of us are. I'm not an attorney, and I haven't been in law enforcement, and we're looking at all these bills, and there's a whole lot of them to pick and choose the parts. How would you, as in the Department of Law, measure whether or not, and I'm not trying to set you up, I promise, that we are right or wrong in the decisions that we're making? I mean, how is the best way to measure the changes that we make to whether or not we're locking up the right people, we're giving treatment to the ones we really should, or are we just, like, clearly missed the mark?
Madam Chair, so that's a very broad question.
It is.
So generally speaking, this is the way that I would think about that. So the criminal justice system at its very core is based on the concept of discretion and relying on the professional judgment of the practitioners. It's an adversarial system by its very design. It has to be an adversarial system. So what you saw pre-SB 91 and our sentencing ranges in pre-SB 91 was that there was discretion provided to the court and to the prosecution and frankly to the defense attorney because it's an adversarial system as to where and what the appropriate sanction should be. And so prior to SB 91, for example, on a Class A felony offense, the range was 7 to 11 if the offender used a dangerous instrument. So within that sentencing range, the court could assign and could impose the appropriate sentence based on the circumstances of the offense. So what I would recommend for the committee is that you recognize that the system by its very nature is based on the use of discretion, that our judges are very well trained to exercise that discretion. We ask them to do that. We ask them to do that based on the information that the parties provide the judge, both the prosecution and the defense. The prosecution will provide the court with the information that it believes either aggravates, frankly, or mitigates the sentence, and also the victim's perspective. And the defense is there to provide the judge with the information necessary to mitigate or reduce or take into account other circumstances at that sentence. So my recommendation, again, is to return our sentencing ranges to where they were pre-SB 91. And that's really focused on discretion because one of the things that SB 91 did was it really reduced the amount of discretion by all the practitioners in the system.
Thank you. Representative Knopp.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So not being at all familiar with the judicial system, I guess I'm curious, so when a defense attorney and a prosecuting attorney enters the courtroom and a deal has been reached between them and they present the deal to the judge, does the judge have the discretion to, obviously, to accept the deal or reject it? Does he have the discretion to change them right there on the spot? Can he impose a harsher or lesser sentence? Or does he typically send both back out of the courtroom and tell them to come up with something new?
Through the chair, Representative, the answer to that question generally, well, it depends on how the plea agreement is structured, but generally speaking, the judge has the discretion to either reject or accept the agreement. And that is, generally speaking, the extent of the judge's discretion. The judge does not have the ability to, for example, say that if the agreement called for the defendant to plead guilty to a C felony, and the judge looked at the plea agreement and looked at the facts and said, I think this should be a B felony. The judge doesn't have the ability to tell the parties this has to resolve at a B felony level. That's outside the court's discretion. That decision and that discretion rests solely with the prosecution. But the court can look at a particular plea agreement and say, this sentence is too lenient under these facts. Or, conversely, the court could look at the sentence and say, this is too harsh under the fact. What the court doesn't do, though, is say, I find this sentence too lenient, and therefore I'm going to impose a different sentence. That's generally not what happens, and instead he or she would send the parties out of the room to renegotiate that plea agreement.
Okay. I appreciate that answer. That's very enlightening to me. And follow-up, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
Thank you. So I guess we as legislators here have had the opportunity to have some breakfasts, some lunches with some of the sitting justices. And, you know, so over-the-table conversations, we talked about giving the judges discretion. But it seems like every time we offer discretion, it really goes to prosecutors and public defenders. And so I think my question for you is there a mechanism or should there be where judges actually have that discretion?
Through the chair, I appreciate your question and your comment. And what your question really calls for is a recognition that most cases are resolved via plea agreement. And that is a function of the volume and the relative size or the lack of size of our criminal justice system. Cases have to resolve through plea agreement, let me rephrase. Significant numbers of cases have to resolve through plea agreement because, frankly, the system does not have the capacity to take all the cases to trial or open sentencing. And so when you provide discretion within a sentencing range, you are providing that discretion to the prosecutor and also the court, because it's the court that is going to look at that ultimate plea agreement and determine within that sentencing range if it meets what we call the chaining criteria. So it is absolutely true that prosecutors have a tremendous amount of discretion in the criminal justice system, and we frankly spend a lot of time discussing internally and training internally as to how is the best way to exercise that discretion. It's something that prosecutors take very seriously, and something we recognize how much authority we have in the system. Okay. So you're absolutely right. When you give more discretion to the system, you are also giving more discretion to prosecutors.
Thank you.
Any other questions for the Department of Law? Representative Josephson.
Thank you. Through the chair, Mr. Henderson, there's been a lot of discussion about electronic monitoring for the past week or more. And I'm asking a question the way a professor would, not that I'm suggesting an answer. So I don't want you to think I'm suggesting an answer. But why should a person not believe that on this issue of credit for time served, that the may language in the now infamous subsection D as in David doesn't mean entirely that coming with that is a may not, that as all mays are maybe not, that this one somehow is not that way, if that makes sense. In other words, what compels the judge in this circumstance to very likely grant this kind of credit, as you interpret that language?
So thank you. Through the chair, so Representative, so when you're looking at, and this, the particular statute that we're talking about is 1255.027, particularly sub D, and you're absolutely right. The language of the statute is the court may grant EM, But then you have to read it in conjunction with the rest of the language in the statute, which is may grant if. And so whether or not the legislature intended the result to be absolutely discretionary on the judge, the way the practitioners have interpreted that section is that it's may, and it's a directive to grant that if the offender didn't commit a new criminal offense on bail. So put another way, if the offender did not commit a new criminal offense, there is a presumption, and the practitioners accept that the offender will receive electronic monitoring credit for that time spent on bail. And frankly, the only case that we have that has interpreted this particular subsection, Bell versus State, even the Court of Appeals started with the proposition that if the defendant did not commit a criminal offense on bail, he was entitled to the EM credit. That was the foundational premise in that case. Whether now, if the legislature intended to say that, that wasn't our goal, and what our goal was is to make sure that the court had the discretion to evaluate all the factors and reject somebody's request for EM, if that was the goal, unfortunately, that's not how the practitioners have interpreted that provision.
Follow up.
This is what I needed, Madam Chair, and through the chair. So I think what you're saying, and I see it now, Mr. Henderson, is that that small little letter if or word makes the may, it energizes the may a bit. It gives it some infusion of energy to lean slightly toward accepting of the credit in conjunction with the Bell interpretation.
Through the chair, Representative, that's correct.
So how do you fix it?
So, Madam Chair, one way to fix it is for that provision would be to clarify the legislature's intent that it's what it really wants the court to do is to analyze and consider and weigh all of the sentencing factors and the chaining criteria before it grants electronic monitoring credit.
And is this one of these other cases where a lot of times we rush things through, and I learned a lot on this case, that sometimes the courts will actually go back and listen to us, which that may be a mistake sometimes. But the more clear that we are here when we're presenting our bills and putting things on the record, if we had clarified it better, and I'm kind of blaming myself, so I guess I could do this, does that not help in some of these decisions, or is it just basically how we write the statute in itself?
Madam Chair, the first premise is absolutely correct. So the appellate courts will always look to legislative intent when it's interpreting the statute, even when one could argue that the language, the plain language of the statute is very clear. Under Alaska law, we always look towards legislative intent. How much weight we place on legislative intent depends on how clear the underlying statute is, but you're absolutely correct. The more clear the intent of the legislature is, the better for all practitioners and ultimate appellate opinions.
Thank you. When Representative Harker was here, there was sometimes he would drive some of us crazy because he would be very detailed in his presentations. And I think he probably knew what a lot of us didn't know is if you don't necessarily get it completely detailed into the things in the statute, if you've made it clear, as your statements have been very consistent, at least give that option to the attorneys to go back and look at. Representative Josephson, followed by Representative Carpenter.
Through the chair, Mr. Henderson, it strikes me that the other problem with not granting it, if the restrictions are met and they're confined to a residence, and the other very few things there, is that at some point the defendant's entitled to a piece of paper called an order that says why the judge said, I'm not doing it. And if the best the judge could come up with, not that it doesn't sound awfully good to my ears, is I don't like you, or you're really violent, that's given that in the next section or a couple sections later, it's this program of credit is open for all sorts of violent offenders, it leaves the judge making what looks like a capricious and arbitrary decision. Does that sound right?
So through the chair, Representative, you make a very good point, and one of the things that you see in the administration's grant package is frankly, the reduction and elimination of EM credit while on bail. And then really because the time served really should be left to the court, the sentencing court, and the Department of Corrections. And if the Department of Corrections determines based on a full risk assessment that somebody should be released on electronic monitoring, that's within their discretion.
Thank you, sir.
But the bill would take electronic monitoring pretrial totally away. The only discretion that would be left is whether or not someone should be on electronic monitoring, but the credit would no longer be there in other bills that are out there.
Madam Chair, that's correct. And one thing to remember about that is when the court is assessing whether to release somebody pretrial and on electronic monitoring, what they're assessing is the bail for purposes of bail, not for purposes of sentencing. So in other words, what the court's assessing is this person a public safety risk, and is this person a flight risk? That's what they're assessing when they assess bail. When a judge pronounces a sentence as to somebody, they're assessing, the judge at that point is now assessing all these other sentencing factors. So it's really the court is conducting two separate analyses, both one during pretrial and one during sentencing, and to then apply the pretrial EM credit to the sentence, you're imposing that time or granting credit for that time when that's not what the court was considering at the time the court released this person on bail.
Thank you. Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is something that was brought up on the House floor earlier today regarding this topic. Was what I would assume would be a fairly good defense strategy would be to delay and obfuscate the process if the longer my client is on electronic monitoring, there is a potential that the credit is going to cancel out any jail time they may serve or minimize the amount of jail time they might serve. So is that something that is a plausible or feasible reality right now?
Through the chair, Representative, in my experience as a prosecutor, I do believe that that occurs. I believe that either an offender or depending on the circumstances, their attorney, there's a real concrete benefit to remaining on bail if you're going to get credit for that that time on EM, especially when you don't know whether or not Department of Corrections is going to authorize you to be released on electronic monitoring or if they're going to require you to serve your ultimate sentence in a Department of Corrections facility. So there's an incentive to have the case be delayed and have the case continue to proceed in a pretrial status. And one of the things that ends up happening is you end up with this pretrial delay, which is a concern that I think all those who are working within the system recognize is really damaging to the system, and it's something we're trying to get a handle on.
And a follow-up, and maybe it's more a statement at this point because I don't think we've got the numbers in front of us, but the number in both time wasted and money wasted in the delay that is brought on by a strategy to delay is probably fairly significant, I would guess, with hundreds, if not a thousand people on electronic monitoring that are engaging in this delay. So anyway.
Any more questions for Mr. Henderson? Seeing none, thank you so much for being with us here on a Saturday. We greatly appreciate it. The last group we have today is corrections. And online we have Ms. Winkleman back, as well as we have Deputy Commissioner Good with us. Ms. Good, could you please come to the table? And Ms. Winkleman, could you please put yourself on the record?
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is Jen Winkleman, Director of Probation, Parole, and Pretrial.
Thank you. We had some questions earlier that we had postponed because we wanted to have the Department of Corrections when it came to electronic monitoring. We're going to go back to Representative Josephson on your – were you the ones that had the questions?
Cue the memory, I guess. I don't recall.
So I think I was Representative Merrick. I was close. One seat off. Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Earlier, I had a question regarding the electronic, the physical devices that are required for electronic monitoring. And we learned earlier today that they are not GPS devices, that they basically talk to a base station unit. And so I wanted to confirm that this legislation includes the base station and any other portion of it that's not the actual ankle monitor. Any tampering or destroying of that is the same as if you destroyed the ankle monitor. And if you have these base stations in other locations, such as a work, you know, something like that, how do you how do you manage those to make sure that they're not tampered with by someone else than the defendant?
So through the chair, Representative Merrick, we do have GPS. I guess I'm not sure about the information that we've received about our electronic monitoring equipment. So the first thing that I just wanted to clarify is that we do have GPS monitoring equipment. In some areas, it doesn't work on it as well with, you know, for cellular reasons and different things, but we do have GPS equipment. As far as the base station, the equipment that is on the ankle is really what is the concern of getting tampered with, and it talks back to the base station. And our probation officers are trained in reading the alerts and working with the company to determine whether or not it's something that's being tampered with versus something that's going on with the faulty equipment. And so I guess I just, in my experience, I have not seen the issue of somebody else messing with the base equipment or anything like that. And for the most part, everything is running through our GPS system. And so you're able to get in fairly real time what's going on with the defendants that are on the ankle bracelet.
Follow-up, Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So are the ankle bracelets being monitored 24/7?
Through the chair to Representative Merrick, yes. What is happening is it's talking to kind of, I would liken it to a call center that is monitoring all of the equipment 24 hours a day. It kind of goes into a database, and our probation officers can access it 24 hours a day. But should an alert come forward, the probation officer is notified immediately when the alert comes in through the call center that is managing all of the equipment.
Follow up. You broke up a little there for me. So the call center would notify the probation officer or the parole officer that there was an alert?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, yes. So the call center that monitors all of the equipment that everybody has on them 24 hours a day, and if there's any sort of tampering, alert, low battery, a strap's not touching skin, trying to think of all the different proximity alerts, if they're going into an area they're not supposed to go into, those alerts will come across immediately, essentially to the call center, which then dispatches out to the probation officer to say an alert has happened. Also, you know, at the same, you know, simultaneously, the probation officers can access the entire database, entire caseload, on a computer system and look at anything that is going on with any of the offenders that are on the program at the time. So if they weren't looking at it, the alerts are still going to go through, kind of like to a 911. I could liken it to like a 911 call center. The alerts from the equipment are going through to the company that's monitoring it 24 hours a day, and they're sending the alerts out to the probation officer for response.
Thank you. One last follow-up. How are the ankle monitors being tampered with, or, you know, cut? They say you cut it off. I mean, how is that done? Is it terribly difficult to do?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick, it is. They can cut it off. I think for liability purposes, that we've been told
and D.C. Good may be able to answer this a little bit better than myself, but I know that there are some liability purposes, that it has to be able to be removed in the case of an emergency. And so it doesn't, it takes more than a pair of scissors to get it off, but it does, you know, you are able to take it off. And quite frankly, and I believe I said this, I'm not sure if I said this in this committee or in another committee, but I was able to look at the amount of escapes for those that are on sentenced electronic monitoring in the last 12 months. And that, the percentage was less than 1% of the folks that we had on. And what I think, the reason I think that's important to share is that the Department of Corrections has a risk assessment, as Mr. Henderson pointed out, that place the folks on electronic monitoring. And what happens is if somebody is, when we get the alerts that the company sends us or that the probation officer happens to be in real time logging into the system and sees an alert going on, response-wise, we're able to respond to the alert immediately to figure out whether or not it is something faulty with the equipment, if it is something faulty that we've received, faulty in the hookup, or if it is truly an offender tampering with it. And then at that time, they will return back into a jail bed into custody and not be on electronic monitoring. So the fact that we don't see a huge number of folks in a sentenced electronic monitoring status in any sort of tamper with their electronic monitoring equipment.
Thank you very much. It seems we received some bad information earlier today.
So just a follow-up on that. So we heard that there was somebody who got lost on a trail, and they happened to be on electronic monitoring, and no one could find them. How could something like that happen?
To the chair, I'm not certain. Like I said, in some different areas, they will have different equipment that I know, you know, 10 years ago, our equipment wasn't GPS ready. And it had to talk to the base back at the house. But now, for the most part, our equipment, all it has the GPS equipment on it, unless they're in a community that it didn't, that the GPS part didn't work.
Perfect. Thank you. Representative Sullivan Leonard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd actually like to go back to the bill with regard to the addition to HB 20 with information regarding misconduct involving controlled substances. And I think I have it correct. Section 25, page 14, I believe that's the start of HB 49, which has been partially incorporated into this piece of legislation. And my question is pretty basic, but I'm hoping Deputy Commissioner can assist me here. Some of the biggest challenges we've heard in our community is with regard to drug users, drug offenders, those who are, you know, making the composition of meth or distributing heroin or using, that we have that revolving door where they are not being sentenced for a long period of time for use, for manufacturing, et cetera. And with the inclusion of 49 into this particular piece of legislation, is that going to close that gap that we have seen before with regard to drug users continually coming in and out of jail? And if so, sorry, I don't understand this whole bill yet, so I'm trying to fact find. But if so, on the receiving end then in corrections, are we prepared then for a larger number of people entering into the prison system? And we'll need rehabilitation.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. Kelly Good, Deputy Commissioner of Department of Corrections. So you had several questions there. So let me kind of take them in steps. The sentencing part, I would like to defer that to either law or courts. We're on the downstream side, right, of all of that. So I don't want to step on their toes. That's their area. As for being ready, I think that will be reflected in the fiscal note, which the chairman has asked us to get prepared and I think be ready to speak to them tomorrow or at least the next day or two.
We're going to give you till Monday morning.
Monday morning, and we will be ready. And at that time, I think you will see that the Department of Corrections is looking at these bills very carefully, making sure we are ready making sure that you understand what these will do and how best to approach that. We've actually taken quite a bit of time in trying to prepare these notes so that this committee and others can see the real numbers.
Thank you. I truly appreciate that.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The number was thrown out here a minute ago, 1%, less than 1% escape from sentenced electronic monitoring. I'm wondering if the pre-sentenced electronic monitoring escape statistic is anywhere near that.
Madam Chair, I'd like to turn that over to Jim Winkleman.
Ms. Winkleman.
Through the chair to Representative Carpenter, that I would have to get you the numbers on. I believe essentially they wouldn't be charged with an escape. It would be charged, the folks that are on in pretrial electronic monitoring status would be charged with violating conditions of release, what we call a VCOR. And so we would have to go through, and that was something I did not in preparation for today's hearing, but we would have to go through our violations VCOR charges for our pretrial defendants to determine how many of them are on VCORs for, any sort of electronic monitoring, either tampering, escape, and I don't know that we would call it escape, but essentially not following their conditions of release.
Okay, that would be good information to have. That's it. I had another thought, and it.
We'll give you time to get that thought back. So we have heard the conversation about the idea of no more pretrial electronic monitoring. I know there's a little over 1,000 individuals right now. Could you tell me, and I know it would just be a guess because right now it's based on the tool and whether or not, whether or not that they could be just supervised or they need more supervision. But of that 1,000, would you think that many of them would stay on electronic monitoring if they no longer got credit and would choose to be in jail instead? Or how do we measure that if that provision were to come about? And that might be maybe Deputy Commissioner, that's kind of a policy call. And it's pretty, I know it's a guess too as far as right now. Maybe first of all, you could just go a little bit more into, I have the risk assessment done, I go in front of the judge, by the risk tool, the judge says, electronic monitoring. First of all, do I as the offender have a choice, first of all, whether or not to be on electronic monitoring or decide to go to jail instead? And let's start there and then we can build on that.
And, Madam Chairman, I would also recommend that Nancy Mead with the courts maybe have something to say with this one too. Or law, actually, maybe Rob Henderson, on whether or not someone could ask to, I'm sure they can ask the judge to be considered for EM. One of the things I would say when
I'm going back to the risk assessment tool that we've heard about. So the risk assessment tool goes to the judge and says, I guess the recommendation would be that this person would be on electronic monitoring. I'm just talking about, I just want you to run me through the risk tool. And maybe Ms. Winkleman, maybe it's a question for you just this first part. So if I'm an offender, I've now been assessed. I'm in front of the judge within my 24, 48 hours there, and it has said that basically I don't know whether I'm a candidate for electronic monitoring or whether I'm forced to do that. I'm just trying to understand, first of all, do I have a choice to go to jail or electronic monitoring first?
I'm not confident that, as Ms. mentioned, Ms. Mead might be able to say exactly what the court would say. However, I think, and I believe we might have talked about it in committee earlier, very rarely do you see somebody that has been given an option to be released from custody and take electronic monitoring. So I very rarely do we see them decline being released if they're given the option. What we're seeing happen through the pretrial is we're seeing folks that are being released on pretrial electronic monitoring, and they don't necessarily have a residence or somewhere to maintain kind of a lifestyle, or where the folks on sentence electronic monitoring, we have gone out from the Department of Corrections side and done a home inspection and confirmed that this is where somebody can live, and that becomes essentially their jail cell, where somebody at pretrial status, I really haven't seen it where they would say, no, they don't want to be on electronic monitoring, they don't want to be released from custody. But what happens is you're seeing them being released to electronic monitoring without in a pretrial status, without support in place, essentially. And so I think that's why, even going back a little bit to Representative Carpenter's question, I think that's why sometimes we're seeing perhaps a little bit larger the VCORE rate on the failure for the pretrial defendants, because the supports aren't set up for them while they're on it as though they are when they're on in sentence status.
Okay. Wait. Ms. Mead, could you come up for a moment? Because maybe I'm just not clarifying, and maybe on the court's portion. It really is a much simpler question that maybe I'm making more complicated. So we're just starting from the beginning because of the idea of the possibility that currently if you're on electronic monitoring pretrial, you now get credit. So I'm walking it backwards to say now you're not going to get credit for being on pretrial. I mean, being pretrial on electronic monitoring, no longer will you be able to get a credit. What I'm trying to understand is I've done the, you know, I've been an offender. I'm getting really worried by saying that too many times. You know, I go to court. I'm in front of the judge now. They've seen my paperwork that says that through the classifications that I could get out on electronic monitoring, which I will no longer get credit for. All I'm trying to find out is, I, as the offender, is do I have to go on electronic monitoring, or can I say, well, if I'm going to not have, get credit, I now would prefer to go to jail because I, you know, want to get this over with.
To the chair, for the record, this is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. I think we're all struggling because that is a hypothetical that none of us in the system can really imagine somebody saying. Nonetheless, because I understand your premise, now that they're not going to get credit, could a person therefore say, well, if I'm in jail, I'll get credit? Right. And that could happen, I suppose, but this is what I think a judge would do, and again, it's hypothetical to me because I haven't had that arise before, is take the risk assessment score and make the bail decision. And if the bail decision is you are going to be released to electronic monitoring, that's just how the proceeding would go. And the defendant could say, or the defense attorney would say, Your Honor, I'd prefer to be in jail because for whatever reason. So there could be different reasons. If the reason is, and the prosecutor might bring this out, this is a homeless individual with no place to plug in the equipment and will not be able to succeed on electronic monitoring, the judge could rethink it and say, you know, electronic monitoring is not then enough to protect public safety and to ensure appearance. So, you know, now I'm going to impose a money bail, which could effectively keep you in jail. But if the defendant were to merely say, I just don't want to be out on EM because I want credit, I do not think a judge would reasonably say, okay, well, then I'll put you in jail, because the judges don't try to use jail as housing for people. Jail, as everybody in the system knows, is imposed in jail time pretrial or post-trial to protect public safety and to ensure the person is deterred and all those other sentencing criteria that might come into play. So I think it would be far-fetched to say the judge would say, oh, because you want credit, I will keep you in jail. I think that would be an unusual thing.
And I'm trying to figure out is whether you even have that choice to start with. So if we were to go back before we had the tool and had that, basically you did have the choice because you had a bail amount, right? And you could say, even if you had the money, you could still say, I don't want to go out on bail. I'm just going to sit here in jail. But this new system has more or less possibly made a choice for individuals versus the system beforehand.
To the chair, I'm trying not to be too confused or confusing, but yes, before SB 91, the judge could say, here are your conditions, and the person could choose not to meet them. Even if the bail amount was $100, they could choose not to meet them. That still could be true, where the judge could say, here are your conditions. I mean, that exact same scenario could play out today. But if the judge says, you are a candidate, my decision is to put you out pretrial on electronic monitors, and the person says, I just plain don't want to, again, I can't imagine the judge saying, oh, okay, then we'll take up a jail bed. And I can't imagine, anyhow, it's a difficult hypothetical for me to put into context.
I guess the reason we're asking, because again, if there's 1,000 individuals out there right now that may have made the, and obviously they didn't make the choice may have been made for them, you know, could that 1,000 individuals are currently out that says, well, if I'm not going to get credit any longer, I want to go where I can get credit, that 1,000 filling up the, would fill up more spaces than what we even have available. So that's, you know, and you could think about it for a little bit longer to make sure that we're clear on that, because we want to make sure that, I mean, that's just one very small piece, that the potential of a lot of people going in to our institutions at a much higher cost. I'm just trying to find out whether or not that is a, what kind of reality that is.
And to the chair, I guess my answers are that, in my opinion, that is not a big reality. I cannot see many individuals preferring to be in jail than being out in electronic monitoring, even given the credit issue that we're talking about.
Thank you. Okay, we're going to take one moment because we're supposed to be in public testimony right now. My issue from doing it, I don't think we necessarily have anybody on, so we'll take a moment, then we'll go right back to questions. So I'm going to open public testimony to HB 20. Do we have anybody online? We do. Good. And that would be, if you could please put yourself on the record, you can start your testimony.
Are you talking to me?
Yes. Hi, Mike. If your name just came up, Mike Coons, please put yourself on the record. You may start your testimony.
Yeah, this is Mike Coons. I'm the president of the Greater Alaska Chapter of AMAC. I strongly oppose the way the criminal justice bills are being worked. Very confusing, to say the least. Is HB 20 a substitute for HB 49 and HB 52? HB 20 never got public input, and according to BASIS, I'm really unsure if heard and adequately debated in state affairs versus judiciary. Now it appears that HB 49 and 52 are added, while neither of them got a hearing of any substance. Thus, I'm very confused that while we have plenty of time to hear fully the governor's bills, we are now doing this on the fly. The House leadership, specifically Representatives Claim in the field, have been leading a concerted effort to ensure that none of the governor's bills that would repeal SB 91 and its foolishness and adverse impact to Alaskan citizens were allowed to move forward. The speaker and representatives claim in the field to have tied up these bills over the last 100 days, and now all of a sudden we're doing this? Representative Klayman has supported SB 91 and opposed every effort to repeal and replace with sound crime-fighting legislation that will protect all Alaskans. The passage of SB 54 last year was seen by the public for what it was, a watered-down effort to appease the voters. It did nothing of the kind in the past election. We voted for Governor Dunleavy for two major reasons, the PSB and crime. This committee's continued effort to oppose the governor, to block amendments, railroad poor legislation in the dark of night, and now how this committee is handling this is understood for what it is, smoke and mirrors. Instead of smoke and mirrors, here, pass out of committee HB 49 through 52 and put to a vote on the floor. Either support the people or support the criminals. Your choice. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coons. And just to let you know that this will not be the last time we have public testimony. As we keep working on the bill, we will have another opportunity to have public testimony. Representative Knopp.
I have a question for Mr. Coons, if he would take a question, Madam Chair. Yep.
Mr. Coons, are you willing to take a question?
Yes.
Okay, Representative Knopp.
Mr. Coons, I'm sorry. When you introduced yourself, you used an acronym for an organization you represent, and I didn't know that acronym. Could you tell me what that organization was, please?
Yes, sir. AMAC is the Association of Mature American Citizens, 4,550 members strong in the state of Alaska.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. Anybody else online? Anyone in the room for HB 20? Seeing none, I'm going to close public testimony. I again want to be able to put it on the record is that as we go through probably Wednesday, we'll have another opportunity as we have another CS that will come out after everybody's amendments to have public testimony again, so everyone will have an opportunity to look at it. So can we bring corrections back up? And Ms. Winkleman is still on, and we have a question from Representative Merrick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, to Ms. Good. And thank you for indulging me. I think this is the most important thing we're going to do this session, and I know District 14 has cried out in opposition to what's happening.
We'll take as much time as the committee needs to and have whatever individuals that you need to have here to make those decisions.
Fantastic. Thank you, Madam Chair. So I want to go back to what we talked about a little earlier, which was the drugs in the correctional institutions. Can you give an assessment of how rampant that actually is, how the drugs are getting into the facilities, and what's being done to kind of curb the problem?
Through the chair, Representative Merrick. So I didn't come today to, prepared to talk about all that, but I mean, I can kind of give you an overview. I think contraband in all correctional facilities are a problem. That is something that we recognize, and I think everybody here recognizes, but it is also something that we are highly aware of and that we are always addressing. So one of the ways is our correctional officers are always, I mean, there was discussion earlier, but by and large, our correctional officers are very concerned about that same thing. Contraband in the facility does not help them either, and that is, so they are trained to look for it and to watch for it and to identify. We take great effort to watch those that come into our facilities. That is obviously one area that it is a way to get in. Anytime you have people entering a facility, it's a risk. Anytime you have an inmate leaving a facility, it's a risk, which is, and we've talked about that here on different occasions. So we are always looking for better ways to reduce the contraband. CODA, the drug dog that I believe was mentioned here before I came in this afternoon, is another way that we are constantly. And I will just say that this administration, the commissioner, very aware and looking for ways to always improve that. That is a high priority.
Thank you. Any further questions? Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Follow up to that exact subject there, and in regards to what we were talking about previously on privacy, does the Department of Corrections have a policy that's announced to the public, maybe by signage as they're coming in, that makes them aware of a change to their rights to privacy by coming into the facility? Is that something that is done, i.e., if you're going to come in, then you are subject to search? I know that I visited, and they have a search process. There's a either a metal detector or x-ray machine or whatever. I can't recall off the top of my head what it was, but there is a process for search. It would tell me that there is a process that we have reduced privacy when we are coming into that facility. And I would like to understand what the Department of Corrections privacy policy is for those two groups of people, the employees and for visitors.
To the chair, let me get you those policies. The Department of Corrections works. We have policies that oversees all of that, and I'd be glad to share those.
One follow-up regarding that. Do you see a problem with employees that are caught bringing drugs in for them getting prosecuted? Understand that an administrative action would be to remove them from employment, but that doesn't mean they're prosecuted because you're not the prosecutor. Do you see that as a problem?
Through the chair, Representative Carpenter, I can't speak on past situations that's happened. What I can tell you is unequivocally this commissioner has said if that happens, she will work with law to prosecute to her furthest ability. So I can tell you that that is what this administration's position is.
Quick follow-up.
Follow-up?
To date, since you guys have came in, mm-hmm. you have not had a situation where there was an individual that was not prosecuted for something that they were maybe removed for bringing contraband in. That has not happened yet that you're aware of.
Through the chair, so I want to be careful. That I am aware of, no. However, I will also say that that in a lot of cases would be a pending case and would not be able to be discussed, but to my knowledge, I don't have one on mind.
Thank you.
And kind of a follow-up to Representative Carpenter, as far as correction officers go and while they're on duty, is there any place within the department, I mean the facility, where it would be, for better way, kind of a sacred area where if a drug dog was going through, that they would be unable to go through that area to check for drugs?
Madam Chairman, through the Chairman, to my understanding, no.
If you find anything different, could you please let us know? We kind of had that discussion earlier. Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just following up just a little bit further on where we're gone, are the policies through statewide through the facilities the same, or are there different policies for different facilities?
Through the Chairman, Representative Tilton, in general, the DOC policies are policies that cover all institutions. That said, because institutions are different and we may have different inmates, the institutions themselves may have different rules and on different things, but those are not the overall policies. The overall policies that manage the department and as a whole, they are the policies for the entire department. And I know that got a little confusing, but there are facilities that have a little bit of a differences. And if there's something specific, I'd be glad to get you that information.
So follow up.
Follow up.
I'm formulating it in my head. So if there's a policy within a facility, particular facility, and it's not a statewide policy, and it was a policy that allowed for some type of event or something that could allow where more contraband might be able to be entered into the system, is it something that the commissioner could change that policy within that facility, or would be willing to do that?
Through the chair, yes, the commissioner would have that ability, and you are correct. There are some facilities. I wouldn't say that that's so the policy would allow an event, right, for different facilities. The individual institutions would have maybe different guidelines for how those events would happen. But overall, yes, the commissioner would have control over those and could cancel or increase, I mean, depending. But you are right again. That is another area of risk.
Thank you. Representative Knopp.
Kind of. If I can, Madam Chair, just kind of down the rabbit hole here, kind of not in regards to HB 20 by any means, but it is in corrections, if you don't mind, and I'm not going to put you on the spot.
We like rabbits. Go ahead.
So I'm curious. I learned a little bit over the last couple of days about DOC that I was not aware of, and basically the amount of your population that behavior health issues, like 65% or something, I think I saw, and then 25% of that even having larger issues. And so I saw that type of service that corrections is providing to inmates or your clients or population. But then the next day I saw all the programs, the rehabilitation, the educational stuff that DOC provides. And I was just astounded at how many different options are out there. So I guess I'm curious, two things is, so like the mental health support that corrections provides, is that a federal mandate, or is that just a humanity thing, or is it a state mandate? And then in the rehabilitation programs that DOC offers and the amount of them, is there any statutes that drive them? And I'm getting to the end of the punchline, but is that just something we're trying to do for rehabilitation? Is this a corrections good faith effort, or did legislators somewhere in the past mandate that type of stuff? And so where I'm going with all this is if there is a mandate and this administration decides to house inmates out of state, would we look for facilities who still offer that same types of services that we offer? And I have no idea, and you may not either, but I thought I'd ask the question, so.
Through the chair, Representative K- Knopf, so taking the questions kind of as you offered them. Mental health-wise, yes, we have a large population, 68%, you're right, from that slide. 22% of our population has severe mental health issues. What guides us in that for laws, I would have to get back to you, but yes, we do that. For one thing, it's the right thing to do for our population. Education, I would look back to the Constitution. Alaska's Constitution, it says that we will, there's reformation of those that we incarcerate. So I would say that's where a lot of our education and classes of such come for. Now, talking about if there we were moving people out of state, because that was your last question, I would say that that the RFP that would be written for that would have to include programming that we believed was necessary for all of that to happen.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions? Representative Tilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just expanding on that just a little bit, when you look at the dollars that are spent within corrections for rehabilitation, I wouldn't really say it's versus, but the education aspect, and you look at the dollars that are being spent for the education aspect in relationship to the inmates that are in the system, how often or are those reviewed to determine whether those dollars may need to be readjusted and better spent in the rehabilitation section?
Through the chair, Representative Tilton, actually, I love that question because that is a concern of ours too. When the administration took over, we were actually quite surprised that many of the programs aren't measured. And that's a concern because you're right. We should be spending the dollars where they have the best impact to help inmates in the transition when they leave our facilities and hopefully becoming law-abiding citizens, right? So that is something that we are taking seriously and are looking into finding ways to measure those and bring that back. I know that this committee has shown interest in that as well. So yes, you're right. We need to do that.
So one last question on the behavioral health issue, and if we have that many with, and I know we do, with severe health, I'm very concerned that corrections is the number one behavioral health. I'm not sure they have the expertise it takes for some of those that we probably have. And then we've heard that a little bit with the API issue as well. As we sometimes look at out of state, and just for the regular prison population, doesn't make sense to me. What would make sense to me is if we have individuals who have severe behavioral issues that can't be taken care of here in our state, have we ever looked at that type of setting out of state to where we could actually get the help that individuals may need, because they're never going to be able to be just out on their own without some type of behavioral mental health assistance?
To the chair, I don't know that we've ever looked at just one, like a correctional facility that focuses mainly on mental health issues. I would gladly check with Laura Brooks on that to see if that's something that's ever been discussed before. I know you've brought it up. I don't know that the facilities exist, but I'd be glad to look at that and see and let you know if we see any that would be willing to take those types of prisoners, you know, in general.
Well, I guess API was probably similar there at one point, being able to give those kinds of assistance, and of course, I'm not sure I've sent anybody there at this point, but I know across the country there are behavioral health institutions that are inpatient to be very knowledgeable and have those kind of programs that I don't think, no matter how good the corrections facilities were, you're just not set up that way. That's just not, you're to lock people up and punish them and hopefully get some education or maybe minimal treatment. But if you're talking about the level that we've been hearing for the last few days, I think it's a level that is much higher than what I believe we should be doing fairly in the institution to Alaskans who probably need an in-treatment type of facility. So I can't imagine they don't exist. Now, how many you would be able to take and how that the logistics would look like. But I guess what I'm missing here, and I think everybody else is, and for anybody else in public safety and the rest of those, is, you know, we're getting ready to embark in another crime bill. And I'm going to speak for just myself. We don't have the statistics and the where for all to know that if we change A and we change it to B, or if we punish people even more than what we are,
is it really, and I think Representative Josephson brought this up earlier, I think everybody agrees when people do bad things, they need to be punished. But at the end of the day, they're going to get out at some point. Are we really fairly giving them that opportunity to succeed once they're getting ready to get out? And is that really where the issue is? And I think everybody in this committee, as we start looking at amendments, are all going to struggle with, is this the right direction? And then how do we measure what we've just done? And probably even fewer of us are still a little skirmish after the last change that we made that didn't quite go to where we thought it was. But I guess in one last defense of SB 91, the thought, and the reason I'll just go with the reason I voted for it was I truly believe that we don't have the treatment for when people get out. I am all for punishing people to the extent that we can, but we also know that they're going to get out at some point. And it seems like our system is made to fail, not made to succeed, because of maybe it's a lack of programming, maybe it's a lack of having behavioral health or mental health assistance to the level that those inmates are right now, and some of it may just be health needs. But we are spending a lot of money. This agency is probably one of the fastest growing agencies because of some of the things that they are required to do. It's not because they're not doing necessarily what they need to do, but if we're going to spend the money, I think we just need to be a lot smarter in how we do that. Are there any other questions or concerns before we end this meeting? Okay, I want to remind everybody that amendments, and it is a soft deadline, and for 6 o'clock on Monday, and what soft means is that if you have it into legal and they don't have it out, by 5 o'clock, I know they have other amendments for the operating budget and others, but if you could just please have it into them by Monday at 5, and just let me know that you're still waiting for them, because we are learning as we go along. But we will plan on starting to take them up on Monday night. Tomorrow, I know you will all be disappointed. We're going to cancel tomorrow's afternoon meeting because the departments need a little bit more time for the fiscal notes that we will hear at 9 a.m. on Monday morning to understand what this current bill and its status does. And the other part is, if you're looking at amendments, if you can check with some of the agencies you'll be impacting to see how much money it may take for that, whatever your amendment may be. I think it's just something we need to be aware of. It's not all about the money, but to me, it's how we spend it, and are we being smart and actually getting what we're hoping for? So with that, Representative Carpenter.
Just a quick comment. Very encouraging to see Department of Corrections, the courts, and I think public safety was in here. We're all in the same room at the same meeting at the same time. That was encouraging.
We must be getting somewhere. So with that, it is 3:54, and we are adjourned.